This is R.J. Rushdoony, Easy Chair Number 255, November 9, 1991. This evening, Otto Scott, Douglas Murray, and I have the privilege of having with us Ian Hodge of Australia. Ian Hodge is a Christian Reconstructionist down under. And for those of you who would be interested, and I believe you would be, he puts out a couple of reports, and if you send him, I hope, a generous contribution, he will add you to his mailing list. Now, mailing from Australia to the States is not cheap, so be generous. The Foundation for the Advancement of Christian Studies puts out an FACS report, P.O. Box 241, Engadine, E-N-G-A-D-I-N-E, New South Wales 2233, Australia. And also, he will send you Christian Economics. And I think you will find them both very, very interesting. In these two that I hold in my hand, the articles are, in both cases, by Ian. The one is The Gun Owner's Arsenal, one of the finest statements on the right to keep and bear arms that I've seen. The other on the social conditions for wealth, which deals with what the alternatives to freedom are. And it is an excellent analysis. I urge you to write, to send in a gift, and I think you'll enjoy these two. And if you have enough copies, Ian, perhaps you could send them these.
We can always make copies of that.
Well, Ian, you were telling us, or you were telling me a little earlier, that the two forbidden subjects of discussion in Australia are politics and religion. So let's break the taboos, both of them, and discuss both subjects. You told us that the ignorance of Christianity outside the churches is quite extensive. And you told us a couple of stories illustrative of that. Could you repeat those stories?
I think on this occasion, under duress, I could repeat them for you. The story is told of two Australians who were wandering through a large outback paddock when they noticed a large bull in the same paddock approaching in their direction. As they were running for the safety of the fence and realized that they would not make it before the bull came upon them, one turned to the other and said, "Quick, say a prayer." His friend Popping replied, "I only know one." "It doesn't matter," he said, "say it." He said, "All right, for what we are about to receive."
I like that one. And the other?
Well, the other is a story that was actually told some years ago by, I'll just have to find it here in the book. We have a very interesting publication in Australia, a recent book entitled Advance Australia Where, which I believe provides a very good analysis of Australian culture in terms of religion and the attitude to Christianity. Australians don't, as you said earlier, the two taboos in Australian culture are politics and religion. It is considered impolite to to kind of broach their subjects. Well, I think it's true to say that politics is, or the taboo against politics has broken down in recent years. The economic effects of the country and the state of the nation there has definitely brought politics to the fore, so that most people are now willing to discuss it. Sorry, I'm just having a little difficulty finding here. This is a story that was told by Sir Keith Hancock, one of our great mining magnates in the country, in a series of lectures he gave in 1973. But the story is two Australians, and one mumbles to his mate, he says, "I'll bet you can't even say the Lord's Prayer." "Bet you too, Bob, I can," says the other. "Go ahead," his friend replies, "say it. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep." "You win," says his mate, "here's your two bob."
Well, let's break the taboos and start with politics. Some of the Australian readers of the Calcedon Report have told us that things are rather grim in Australia now, economically. Would you like to comment on that?
At least since the stock market crash of 1987, Australia has begun to see severe economic repercussions of that event. We had, as one business writer analyst put it, probably in the first 12 months after the stock market crash, we had probably $100 billion written off the value of company businesses, which for a population of about 16 million people is probably a fair amount of money.
Are you talking about our stock market crash?
It was also our stock market crash, and ours was far more severe than what yours was.
Yeah, at the same time.
Same day.
October 80, same day.
Same day.
I didn't know that.
Our market went down for approximately 50% in the few hours of trading on that fateful day in October.
And those companies went under. They didn't just lose, they disappeared, is that right?
Most of them were firms that became bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
If you look prior to that, the events leading up to the demise of those companies, we had had fairly constant inflation through the period, and by inflation I mean their government manipulation of the money supply. That had been running at levels as high as around 18 to 20% per annum for a fairly consistent period from about 1983, when our Labor government came into power, up to that period.
We have about that much. We have that much at the close of the Carter administration, which took us up to 1980.
Yes.
So you went into it 3 years later.
Ours was also high during that period as well.
Uh-huh.
But we have had enormous inflation, or what I consider fairly substantial, at least inflation during the period. So companies had been very prone to the use of debt as a means of expansion, and some had companies had built quite substantial empires on the takeover philosophy, and then re-gearing the asset and stripping the company eventually and going on. To the point now where most of those major players up to that period of the 1987, the last of those big players who's just about to go under with a possible bankruptcy, and that was this one company I'm talking about here was an enterprise that had around $5 billion in assets.
What are the central industries involved?
It's a mixture. Most of these large ones were companies that had built diverse empires.
Mm-hmm.
And
conglomerates.
Yeah.
What's the central industries anyway? I mean, I remember sheep and mining at one point. What else?
They would still be the major ones, especially for the export trade.
Uh-huh.
And we don't have a real lot else in terms of
of industry in such a small population.
Mm. You mentioned the effect on one great family of Australia sending their son to the Harvard Business School. I think that's a story that bears repeating.
It's a good example of what's happened and what prompted it. Otto was just a comment I heard on one of these tapes some time back where you said, I think that the only thing they learn at Harvard Business School is how to go into debt.
Mm-hmm.
But the particular family, the Fairfax family, had started newspapers in the country in the early 1800s.
Mm.
And through the generations had built the most substantial newspaper empire in our country, and the flagship paper, the Sydney Morning Herald, still is the leading newspaper in the country.
Mm.
The current heir apparent had been to Harvard Business School in the early 80s and graduated or came back into the country in towards the end of 1986 and decided that he would privatise the company and buy back all the shareholders, including other family members, aunties and uncles,
mm.
and privatise the company back into his own name and his mother's name as much as possible. To do that, he borrowed $1.7 billion, half a billion dollars of which were junk bonds out of America here. And he did that just prior to the stock market crash and put the whole thing together in about August in 1987. The result was that with the continuing economic decline after 1987, the result was that he's now lost the family inheritance.
The whole thing?
The whole thing.
And it was in the family how many years?
146 years.
146 years.
Who took it over?
The banks.
The banks took it over.
Some of the major banks.
Oh, they do a great job running a newspaper.
Well, they have put it up for sale.
Sure.
As a means of getting the assets back.
Right.
Was the bulk of the money borrowed from other countries?
No, the bulk of it, as far as I understand, was borrowed even within Australia.
Mm. Through stock? Sale of stock or shares of stock?
Through bank loans.
And he borrowed from the bank and he bought the shares of stock back.
So the depositors in the bank ultimately wound up losing.
Well, they got the property.
Depositors in the bank haven't lost anything yet.
Depends on how much they can sell it for.
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt if they can sell it for that kind of money.
How about unemployment now?
Just to finish on the newspaper, the Alcindor valued it possibly around about $1.2 billion. He probably could have made it.
He could have made it.
So, if they wipe out probably half $1 billion of the debt or something like that, then the chances are. And it is being sought after by Australia's richest citizen at the moment, who also owns competitive newspapers and TV station there. Sorry, unemployment. If I can just go back and perhaps paint the picture a little bit from 1987. Following the stock market crash, the government predictably then increased the money supply at a far higher rate. They reached peaks of pretty close to 30% through the period 1988 into 1989.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden they cut that rate back to the last figure I saw down to about 2% per annum. Now, from going from that kind of monetary expansion, from that rate, to cut it back so savagely, then what Australia has experienced in the last 20 months now, since virtually the beginning of 1990, we have seen an extremely severe recession.
So what you've got is from inflation to deflation.
Yes.
So now prices are dropping?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Well, you have an election next year. Are they starting to inflate in terms of that?
How did you guess?
That's what we do here before every election.
The figures are just starting to show in a month-by-month increase again, and it's a little too early to predict exactly what rates, but we face an election at the end of 1992 or early into 1993.
Mm-hmm.
So now would have to be the time they need to recommence cranking up the monetary machine if they're going to do anything. I got unemployment levels, just to let me interrupt you there. Unemployment has grown in the last 20 months from around about 7% up to about 10.2%, was the last figure.
I got a flyer from Scudder Investment Company today that stated that the growth rate in Australia is 114% of that in the United States. I don't know whether they're anticipating this inflation pending increase in the interest rates and growth coming out of that or what, but they that's their current statement that they came out with today.
Our growth rate is flat, so I guess I guess if they had a 2% growth rate, it would be way up there.
I don't know what the growth rate figures are, it's, so I'm unable to comment or know the background to their statement. The company I work for, which is in the financial services industry, we're a financial planning company that help people invest their money. Our managing director addressed us only a couple of weeks back, and he had been to a meeting of stock market people, and the stock exchange was involved, and some of the leading insurance companies. They are predicting a fairly substantial increase in business over the next 5 to 6 years.
Based on what?
Based on the fact that the banks currently in Australia are in a major problem. We have not only had the stock market crash, but in the last 20 months we've also seen 25 to 30% white cloud out of property prices. Now that has created another bout of problems within the society, but especially for the banking community, who have now a large percentage of non-performing loans. Under our regulated banking system, we don't see the banks go under like you do in this country. Although we have seen the equivalent of a couple of savings and loans, what we call building societies, mm-hmm. have gone under. So the banks have really cut back their lending to business.
So the same thing as here.
But Australians seem to be willing to put money personally into business enterprises. We have just seen the Labor government in the country privatise the Commonwealth Government Bank, or at least sell off roughly a third of it. And there were a little over 200,000 Australians who were able to get shares in that float. And they put up about $1 point something billion to buy the shares. And the stock market, the stock exchange people and some of the fund managers over there are saying that if Australians are willing to do this at that kind of level, then they feel that Australians will respond favourably to corporate private fundraising, either through share floats or bond issues.
Are the savings? They have a lot of savings there.
There are substantial savings.
I see. Well, that helps. That makes a big difference. The United States is very thin on the savings end.
Well, we have our savings rate is probably not much higher. But we have, there's a lot of money in the country in terms of dollar amounts. Just to give you one example, I mean, just one fund manager alone, the state government superannuation board in the state where I am, New South Wales, you know, manages about $10 billion.
That's a lot of money. Sam Blumenfeld called me last night and sends his regards and said you have beautiful cities, wonderful cities, great broad streets, clean and so forth. And of course, he lives just outside Boston, which is not very beautiful these days. But he also said it's a very socialistic country.
We are heavily regulated. Whether we're more regulated than America is probably debatable. But we have this history of our British background, of course, gives us very high left-wing activity within the trade union movement. It probably peaked at close to 70% of the workforce involved in the union movement. Now that has started to decline. The union movement has dropped off. it would still be probably those higher 60% of the workforce involved in labour. So what we have is very high protectionism.
You have white collar unions?
There are white collar unions, but they aren't the real force of aggravation.
Uh-huh.
It's the blue collar unions that have been the major source of economic I was going to say mayhem, but that isn't so true these days, because surprisingly enough, with our current Labor government, they have been most successful in managing the economy by doing two things, I think, which were essential to the country. Number one, when the Labor government got into power, and I should just preface that with the statement that our current Prime Minister, Bob Hawke, was the leader of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, the ACTU movement, and was a very...
So he's a union leader?
He's a union leader. He had carved out for himself an enormous popular following, mainly because of his ability to negotiate during the 70s, late 60s and the 70s, when we had a lot of union activity and strike activity. He was able to step in at the last moment and bring off very successful negotiations to prevent last-minute strikes and things like this. He was enormously popular. The Labor Party, which is our equivalent of your Liberal-type party, saw his electoral potential and pushed him into Parliament at a by-election in a safe Labor seat in the late 1982 or sometime in 81, it probably might have been, 81, 82. And very quickly then promoted him to leader of the party, and therefore he became Prime Minister when the Labor people won their vote in 1983. But Mr. Hawke was very successful in negotiating what became known as the Union Accord or the Wages Accord. And what has virtually happened in the last 8 years, he has convinced the unions to take a cut in pay by not keeping the wage rates up with the inflation rate. So Australians have had a substantial cut in income levels over the last 8 years.
He got them to accept that?
He got them to accept it.
He must be a very persuasive man.
He is. You have only to hear him once on television and you know that he comes across as a folksy man who can convince people of whatever he chooses. Mm. He's very impressive that way.
There are not too many men who could sit in front of a TV camera with an interviewer with tears in his eyes confessing adultery and how sorry he was for it, and actually receive acclamation from the population.
Oh, boy. What's his wife say? I mean, that clinches it.
Well, he has an audience that you haven't seen since Franklin Delano Roosevelt's day.
Uh-huh.
What's the unemployment situation like now?
Well, as I said earlier, we've risen in the last almost 2 years from about 7% up to about 10.2%. So it is substantial, and the amount of jobs being offered is probably cut in half over the 20-month period.
Well, this resulted in this country, in blue-collar workers voting much more conservative. Has there been a shift in voting patterns over there yet?
I think the Labor government has started to wear out its welcome with its own support base for a number of reasons. I should say the other thing that the Labor government did, to finish off what I started earlier about what they've done to help the economy. They also brought in balanced or almost balanced budgets, which they have run almost through the period.
Hmm.
Now, we were running budgets as high as $8 billion per annum. And so the Labor government is, surprisingly enough, the left-wing socialistic type government has not only negotiated union workers' wages down, it brought in a balanced budget and embarked on a program of privatization.
That's very interesting. It Is this the same government that blocked American ships, nuclear vessels, and so
on? No, that was New Zealand.
That was New Zealand. I'm sorry. Yeah, it shows you how much I know.
Well, at least Greenpeace hasn't sunk any boats in that harbor and run off.
That's true.
How is the military establishment in defense establishment in Australia? Is it kept at a very minimal level, or is it growing? Or?
No, it has been, if anything, scaled down. The current government has poured most of the resources into welfare, and so the military has suffered, you know, as part of it.
Big welfare bill?
Yeah.
Well, all those unemployed, are they getting welfare? Are they getting unemployment benefits or whatever?
Yeah, they can get welfare fairly easily. Mm-hmm. They are proposing to begin to limit that, mm-hmm. and that will create political backlash for them. You made a comment earlier about socialism in Australia, and mm-hmm. it is very right. We have, I started to talk earlier, the protectionism in industries there. To give an example of our economic status, our salary level dollar for dollar is probably in some way similar to what it is here, at least from the brief chat I've had with some Americans in recent days. And say, you know, a $50,000 salary here, mm-hmm. I'd probably get the same, or somebody in Australia doing similar work could probably get the same salary. Our personal tax levels on that, though, expand as high as 48 cents in the dollar, plus another 1.25 cents Medicare levy.
Well, that's higher than ours. We go up to 33 now, begin at 28.
Yeah.
Incidentally, there, Rockefellers have put are putting a lot of money into Australia, and there's a sort of a millionaires or multi-millionaires colony down there of Americans who are buying up large estates, putting up very expensive establishments. Non-business, so far as I know.
Hmm. In, do you know where?
No, I don't. But I do know a retired executive from Exxon who is part of that group, who is he's been going back and forth to Australia quite a bit. He's very intrigued with the country. And I think they're looking at it as a refuge because these are rather far-sighted individuals who see increasing disorder here.
The smaller population probably does lend itself to a lifestyle, especially out of the major cities, that you know, is very conducive, and we have a fairly laid-back lifestyle and without the pressures that, that are there.
Does Australia encourage or discourage foreign investment?
They have an ambivalent attitude to it. Publicly, they tend to discourage it, but practically, I think they encourage as much as they can. And we need it. We don't have the internal resources to develop what we really have there.
You haven't reached the Canadian stage. They're selling citizenships. They really are. If you have enough money, you can become a Canadian citizen.
We are doing that to the people in Hong Kong who want to get out.
Oh, you are.
I was told by a bank officer that in order to qualify for consideration mm-hmm. to enter the country, mm-hmm. it's only to be considered,
right.
a Chinese family had to deposit $250,000 into a bank account for at least 2 months.
Australia seems to be giving up its exclusively white policy.
The white Australia policy was abandoned probably during the 70s. I'm not, I couldn't exactly date it, but that's when the fairly strict regulations of who could come in was abandoned.
Are there many Hindus coming in?
Not a real lot of Hindus. We have a growing Muslim population, Arabs coming in.
Oh, Arabs.
And
that's surprising.
Turkey.
What from, brings them?
What, from what? From Arabia?
From Jordan, around those areas, and you know, countries surrounding that. And I was just recently employing staff, and I had a young Kuwaiti man who was a refugee from the recent troubles there, had come to the country and was job hunting by himself, so no doubt he will settle down and then apply to bring his family in.
It's fairly easy to enter Australia then.
It's easy if you can get the approval. I'm not sure what the approval regulations are, having never applied to enter my own country, so.
Well, we don't know here either anymore. We used to know. Are they looking primarily for people with skills?
Yeah. If you have certain skills, the entrance requirement is pretty easy. We do have a targeted figure each year which the government allows. Within certain skill ranges, I think the figure is, you know, 100-odd thousand, you know, immigrants per year can come in.
Of course, your location, you know, you're an island, and a way distant island, too. So you don't have our problem. People are pouring in from Mexico and from Canada. We have an unprotected border on both sides. We used to be very proud of that. I'm not sure that we're still so proud of it, but some are.
Yet, on the other hand, we have living just to the north of us, though, the Indonesians, and I met an interesting man who was involved in military intelligence at one time, who claims that he saw maps captured from the Indonesians, which had Australia marked off as part of their own territory.
Well, that's possible.
Which would be interesting. And the Indonesians do have a history of expansionism to some extent. And while we may be an island, we are not that far. We've had boat people come down from Vietnam and reach our shores without too much trouble. Mm-hmm. But Australia has really created a problem for itself with its own immigration policies by limiting so that the influx of people in, rather than perhaps encouraging the right kind of people into the country. We have a very small population for the amount of land that we have. And in the current economic situation worldwide, where you've had a massive drop in prices of commodities and items like that, where we've had, sheep just killed, slaughtered, you know, in the fields because it's not worth bringing them to market. If we probably had double the size of the population, our rural community could probably be self-sustaining out of the local population, but it's not large enough. So our grain growers and our sheep herders need to find export markets to maintain their properties.
Are they able to market the wool as well as the meat?
No, we've had a massive problem there earlier this year with some several million dollars of bales stuck there. We had a price subsidy scheme where the government purchased, through the Wool Corporation, purchased all Australian wool and then resold it out to the world markets. But it's $7 a kilo or whatever it is when the world market was only willing to pay $2 or $3. We had a glut of wool. And we had many Australian farmers go under because of the sudden price drop, and the government has actually abandoned the Wool Corporation and thrown the whole thing out to...
The wool market has never recovered from World War II. So many synthetic fabrics have come along, and central heating has increased and taken over in the cities, so that there is no longer the same necessity for wool clothing in the winter.
Yes, we grew up with wool clothing.
Yes.
And now a wool suit costs more than any other.
Yes. You simply switch to wool in the fall when Otto and I were young. And after the war, the sheep industry here died for two reasons. First, the servicemen came back from the South Pacific having had rancid mutton to eat and telling their mothers or their wives that no mutton or lamb was ever going to cross their plates again. And second, the synthetic fabrics. The sheep industry was tremendous. It used to be that this area right here, for example, and all the foothills and mountain areas had sheep that would be brought down in the valley to winter in the fields there on the stubble. And now the sheep industry in this state is minimal. And it's Colorado and other states were once tremendous producers of lamb and wool. It's minimal everywhere now.
Is it true that you have hamburgers or burgers made out of kangaroo?
If there are, I've never seen them.
Lance, a very good mutton. My wife and I were invited on board an Australian aircraft carrier that called in San Francisco Bay, and the second in command invited us aboard. And I think the cook was probably specially trained in 147 ways to cook mutton, but it was very good.
Kangaroo meat is very similar to beef, and it's very nice to eat. Living in coming from a rural community where we would often go shooting kangaroos, they can be a nuisance and break down fences and destroy the crops. So, roo meat I've eaten, it's palatable, quite well.
Well, they live on grass, don't they?
Yeah.
So it should be edible.
Well, the sheep industry here, there still is one. I understand that the meat is less adulterated or has less hormones and injections and so forth. It's the only area that the FDA doesn't fool with. The government leaves alone. It's the sheep and it's the natural, you're getting the natural meat.
But how much lamb do you see in the market?
Not too much.
Yeah, that's
and lamb I'm very fond of.
I am too. But most of your good lamb is sold to restaurants.
Hmm.
And what the restaurants don't take go to the meat markets.
Well, of course, to go back there on the wool problem, what we have to understand is that in Australia, with our subsidized price ordered by the government artificially holding the price up, what they effectively did was create an oversupply of wool. And, of course, it came to the head where the government suddenly didn't have the funds to pay out for the current wool crop. So they really didn't have much choice but to turn around to the farmers and say, well, you know, we've made a mistake. But of course, the farmers have borne the brunt of the bureaucratic error.
We haven't done that yet. We've got enormous agricultural subsidies, which we cannot afford. And we have, we've lost millions of farmers in recent decades. And the Department of Agriculture now has 150,000 employees. It had something like 25,000 when we had a big agricultural sector.
Is there a viable candidate to oppose Bob Hawke? You have an election next year, don't you? 92.
Or shortly thereafter. It can be held in this up into 93. No, we don't have a viable alternative, at least not that I think is a viable alternative. We have the Liberal Party as the major party in opposition, but they
historically have found themselves to be just as left-wing as the left-wing unions.
Is there any attempt at an alternative party, a third party?
There are a growing number of independents being elected into Parliament, primarily at the state level, not so much into federal level as yet. So there is voter backlash against the political arena.
What about the identity card? Is that an Australian problem?
It was to be an Australian problem. They did attempt to introduce that in 1987 and 1988. It was a drop. There was a large political backlash to that. Although we have now what is called the Clayton's ID card. Not sure whether you Americans understand that phrase.
Oh.
We have a non-alcoholic drink called Clayton's Tonic, which is very nice with dry ginger ale. And the advertising copy for the drink is the drink you have when you're not having a drink. So we have coined the phrase to, you know, Clayton's can be used in a number of circumstances.
I see.
The environmental movement and the fawning adulation of Aborigines seems to be as well underway in Australia as it is in the United States.
I can't comment about America because I don't know what's happening here. We have had enormous amount of territory handed back to the Aboriginals, and what amounts virtually to an establishment of apartheid within the country. They are given their own territory, they can run their own laws, and they're self-governing on that within certain limitations.
How many Aborigines are there?
I don't know what the
population is. That's a small number, isn't it?
It's not large, but virtually now if they can prove that it was once tribal land and held some religious significance, the government is almost handing it back, and there are quite a few claims apparently that are being fraudulently used by the Aboriginals.
Well, you have two types of Aborigines, don't you? You have the Maoris.
No, the Maoris. They're in New Zealand.
That's New Zealand.
Well, then you have the, they're very primitive, are they not?
Oh, yeah.
They are blacker than Africans.
No. Yeah.
Very black.
So is this a great favor to them?
Yes, to some of them. One of my best friends during school was a part Aboriginal who currently works for the Department of Aboriginal Affairs, a national government department. He's totally cynical and sceptical of what the government's doing because he sees firsthand. Of course, there's a man who has risen through the ranks to moderate middle-class success without going the... this is my historical land route. And they have just thrown welfare at the Aboriginals really without any concern either for the Aboriginals' welfare or anything else. It's been political game. For example, they had the establishment of a turtle farm, on the Queensland coast, which was...
How about alcoholism among the Aborigines with that type of indulgence?
It's bad.
The South Africans were, when I was in South Africa in 82, I think, very indignant, I guess you'd say, or surprised over the Australian criticisms of South Africa's apartheid. And they seem to think that they didn't expect that from Australia. I don't know why not.
Doesn't anyone criticize their policy there with regard to Aborigines as apartheid?
The comment has been made. Some of the most interesting readers reading in the newspaper has actually been out of the South African ambassador in Australia.
Mm.
The only way that he could get a fair hearing in the Australian media was to pay for roughly a quarter page advertisement, which he ran most Saturdays in our most national Saturday paper, The Australian, or The Weekend Australian. And those columns that he wrote have become very popular, to the point they're even now published in book form.
Is that so?
And he really told the story quite well. And when the government would say one thing, he would come out and say, but you know, you're practicing apartheid. We are actually in the process of dismantling it, even there, despite your criticisms. And he won a lot of support for South Africa through those articles.
The Australian is a libertarian paper, quite unusual. I don't think we have anything comparable to it here.
Well, it probably tends to publish some free market aspects a little more favorably. I'm not sure that it would be classified as libertarian, but it's definitely been the national paper for the expression of some of those freer ideas.
Well, we certainly don't have any. There's a few little newspapers in New Hampshire. There's the Oklahoman, which is never quoted. Joe Farah lost his job for turning his little paper conservative. Practically all our papers speak with one voice. We outdo Pravda.
I think it's probably true. The Australian news press speaks with one voice. The Australian is probably unique in that it is willing to publish alongside an occasional contrarian viewpoint.
It was very vocal a few years ago when I was there, and it was quite new. Has it drifted since then?
No, it's probably maintained its status over the years. The current owner of that paper, of course, is Rupert Murdoch, who's buying quite a few of the newspapers and media outlets in this country. So.
Yeah, Murdoch became an American citizen. There's a rumor that his money comes from Oppenheimer of South Africa, but it's only a rumor.
How about Fred Niles and his Christian Party in New South Wales? Any signs of that spreading or growing?
No, if anything, that's probably declining. Fred's been unique in the Australian landscape in that he's been able to break the taboo on religion and politics and combine both of them very well. Although his traditional stand on Christianity, at least in the political arena, is probably could be confined to the areas of abortion and homosexuality have been his major campaign platforms. He was just re-elected again this year by a very slim margin. His party suffered a fairly substantial split 3 or 4 years ago, which I think has damaged the cause. But on the other side of it, I think we've also seen the abandonment of Christian concern over the political arena in Australia, at least since 1988. There was quite active opposition to the national identity card that was being proposed under the Labor government. And then at least in New South Wales, we had also had a Labor state government that was proposing quite draconian legislation in the area of education control, which moved, which would have at that time moved right down to very tight control of the curricula within the schools as well. The Labor government was defeated primarily, I think, on that education issue and maybe one or two other areas. On the gun issue, they also had taken a stand against, and the Sporting Shooters Association in the country had mounted a very active campaign. And the Christians came together in the state quite well on the education issue. But almost since 1988, it's almost as if, well, we've done our best and we can all go back and do whatever we normally do. And the political involvement of Christians in the country has declined quite significantly and quite dramatically, quite unexplainedly.
Well, they won their case, I guess, and they've relaxed,
Well, they didn't really win. The Liberal government in the state brought in an education bill at the beginning of this year, which was their promised alternative, which almost did exactly what the Labor government promised to do. They now have curriculum control, or curricular control
within certain broad categories, that all schools who wish to comply and sit students for the government examinations, and all examinations within the state for university entrance are government examinations, then the school must comply with these curriculum requirements. And there's a local Christian school near where I live. They're currently having a battle with the education department over some content material that is to be taught in the area of, you know, sex education material and, you know, drug material and things like that.
Do you have homeschooling?
Homeschooling is fairly small, but what the state government has brought into the state now is a Clayton's registration system, where now you are free to homeschool and you are free to have a Christian school outside the state system, providing you seek non-registration of your school, that you seek an exemption. And the actual exemption is tighter than if you want to operate a Christian school. If you wanted to operate a private Christian school, they would assess that you are capable of teaching the required curriculum. If you want what is called a religious exemption from the state system, then they will not only assess you as to whether you're still going to teach the state curriculum in your private Christian school, but they also reserve the right to see if you genuinely hold to your religious conviction, and that is really why you are seeking the exemption. So it is a double whammy.
Well, what about religion in the public school, the government schools?
Which religion are you talking about in the government school?
Any religion.
Huh? Oh, humanism is right, of course.
Yes, of course. But the Christian religion?
The Christian religion has now been relegated to a lower level up until the current state, and I'm speaking for my own state because that's what I know the best. Up until the introduction of this new bill into the state beginning of this year, it was possible to have up to an hour instruction per day in religious instruction in classes. That has been reduced down to 1 hour per week. It probably practically means nothing, because I don't know of any church group of any sort that would have been utilising more than 1 hour per week. They would have gone in and taken a one-period class or whatever. But we had an interesting case there when the Education Act was debated in 1988. There was an Anglican minister in the country region who had resigned from teaching in the local high school. And the issue, which only made a very small clipping in the paper, and I eventually contacted the man to discuss it with him because it was an interesting case. He had resigned because a circular had been put out by the Education Department saying that if any minister wanted to teach, or anybody teaching religious instruction, that was teaching viewpoints which the department was not happy with, they could rightly interfere into the content of what was being taught in the religious instruction classes. Now, that's not law, that's just bureaucratic regulation. This man had resigned the position because he said, I'm the bishop in my area, he said, and no one tells me what I can and can't teach. Now, he was a high churchman, what we would tend to call liberalish in his viewpoints, but he rightly saw that here was the state interference and state control of religious instruction. He resigned, and he resigned not because he had a problem. He said, I'm teaching the ideal situation. The headmaster in the local school was a deacon in his church, elder in his church, so he had no problems. It was just this official position being taken, and he felt he needed to make a stand against it. But no one saw the issue and stood with him.
Yeah. England has a state religion, has a Church of England. Australia doesn't have a state religion.
Only insofar as we are still tied to Britain. And that's a very tenuous tie.
The Church of England has no special status there.
No, only insofar as the monarchy still, you know, has some bearing into the Australian political scene. And that's,
but you don't have an official religion. And obviously what little you've had is being diminished.
We've never had a strong religious practice in the country.
Mm.
We were founded by convicts, not Calvinists,
mm-hmm.
like your own country here.
Mm-hmm.
And religion was very much part of the establishment, the Anglicans and mm-hmm. even the Methodists, early Methodists. Some of the clergymen were given positions as magistrates in the early colonies. One became known as the flogging parson. And I think that our country's antagonism to Christianity really does go back to the roots of the country.
Our time is almost up, but let me say something in defense of this convict origin of Australia. You recall that at that time in England they had some 200 offenses whereby a man could be hanged, from stealing a loaf of bread or a shilling. Now, the purpose of those laws was not really to hang men. It was to give them the choice, and it was to depopulate the country because they felt they had too many poor people. So the choice was either to hang for stealing a loaf of bread or a shilling, or go to Australia as a convict. So the idea that there are a lot of bad people who are shipped to Australia is nonsense. They were worked as convicts, incredible tasks assigned to them, roads built. I saw one place about 80 miles out of Sydney where they bridged over almost a generation a gap, a canyon between two mountains by hauling rocks and throwing them there until they reached a level where they could build a road across. But those people were not convicts in any modern sense. They were very poor people against whom this terrible law had been passed in order to give them a choice between hanging and emigration. Well, with that, we'll conclude this session and thank you all for listening.